Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa and I'm here with Nicola.
Hello.
Heather.
Hi.
Pat.
Hi.
Stephanie.
Hello.
And Linda.
Hello.
This week on Write Club, we'll be chatting about the detective in fiction. Pat will be sharing the next instalment of her work in progress. We'll be discussing our writing lives. And Stephanie and Andy Larter will be sharing what's on their bedside table. Before I go to Heather, I just want to share a bit of feedback I got from a listener who I met at a party. Pat said she's not the kind of person who normally joins clubs or groups, but she really feels part of the podcast group when she listens, which is lovely. That's exactly what we were hoping for. She also said it would be nice to put faces to names because nobody knows what we look like, or some people do. But we'll be putting our picture up on the Facebook page and group so you can see who we are and what we look like. Okay, but now Heather is going to ask us to
name the novel.
This novel was first published in 1961. It's set during World War II and it's written in the third person omniscient.
Okay.
World War II,
1961. Well, that would
fill a whole lot of novels. I don't know the dates, but there's a few. Yeah, Let's have another clue.
It was made into a feature film released in 1970 to poor reviews, but has since become a cult favourite.
Okay, I think I'm there.
I think I know that one then.
Go on.
It was love at first sight. The first time Eusebian saw the chaplain, he fell madly in love with him.
Yeah, definitely got it. Yeah. Great novel. Love it. Yeah.
No idea.
Yep.
Right.
Only from that third clue.
I got it on clue two, but, you know, because
as a cult classic.
It's Catch 22 by Joseph Heller.
And Joseph Heller is an American author of novels, short stories, plays and screenplays. His best known work is the novel Catch 22, a satire on war and bureaucracy, whose title has become synonym for absurd or contradictory choice.
Yes.
And the quote was always crazy and could be grounded. All he had to do was ask. And as soon as he did, he would no longer be crazy and would have to fly more missions. All would be crazy to fly more missions and sane if he didn't. But if he was sane, he had to find them.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say Rocky Horror Picture Show because it's the only cult that...
It's not in the
Second World War.
And then I didn't know if it was even a book. Is it just a film?
Interestingly, I saw a collection in a second-hand bookshop years ago, and I wished I'd bought it, of American short stories. And there was a short story which was a precursor to Catch 22 by Joseph Heller. And I think it was originally called Catch 19, which doesn't have the same ring to it. And as you say, there's not many writers that have given us a phrase like that that's kind of really come into
language.
We all use it even if we don't really know the origins of it as an impossible choice.
Really. He started to write this in 1953, but did put out a few things before this one was actually published.
7 years, well, there's hope for me.
I've already exceeded that, not got past chapter four, so. Okay, thank you, Heather. Now, Pat is going to read the next instalment of her story about Mark before we give her some feedback.
Oh, good.
Okay. It was 3 months before Peter was released from hospital. Although he'd regained some movement, there was paralysis down his right side and he needed a wheelchair, and speech was still difficult. Mariana was adamant that Mark should stay with them. But this is your home now, and I need you to help with Peter and to see to the garden. Please stay. At first, it seemed to work well, and Mark was happy, feeling needed, valued. But gradually, he began to feel that he was losing Mariana. With Peter back home, there were no more evenings looking at photographs, listening to Mariana's stories, or laughing at some silly programme on the television. Her attention now was almost entirely focused on Peter. The security and, yes, happiness that Mark had started to feel seemed as though it were being ripped away from him again. And he worried. Peter remembered nothing of events leading up to his stroke now. But would his memory come back? Would his speech improve? Would he be able to tell Mariana the truth about Mark? And what would happen then? That would be it for me, he thought. If he reckons I pushed him, they might get the police involved. And then where would I be? Back in the nick, probably. Every day was an agony of waiting and wondering, terrified of what might happen. Would it be today? Or maybe tomorrow? Every night, Mariana would say how much better Peter seemed. Soon he will be back to his old self, I think. And she would look at Mark, her eyes pleading. Yeah, of course he will. While inside he was praying, please, no. He needed to think, to plan. He needed to get out of the house where increasingly he was beginning to feel like an outsider again. He spent hours in the garden, and as he worked, he considered the possibilities. He could just leave, move on. Yeah, that'd be safest. Tell him some story about a new job. He'd be all right. Probably get someone to come in and help. Social services, maybe. I could just... What? What could he just? The prospect of leaving, of finding some grotty flat, of trying to survive on job seekers, filled him with despair. No, there had to be another way. He could just take a chance. Hope that Peter never remembered those moments before his fall. Never remembered Mark pushing past him, knocking him off balance. And what if he did remember? He hadn't pushed him on purpose. It was an accident. But what about the other thing? The newspaper. The report. Peter's face as he realised the truth. Might be all right. They were nice people, Peter and Mariana. He'd done his time. Paid his debt, the governor had said when he called him in his office before his release. Second chance now, lad. Make the most of it. New name, new life, fresh start. And he was such a good boy. Mariana was always telling him. Tears welled. Telling Mariana. Seeing her expression change. Feeling her pull away from him. Even if she was kind, understanding, forgiving. He couldn't bear it. She would never feel the same about him. How could she?
Well, thank you, Pat.
What a dilemma.
But you're scaring me so much, because I'm thinking, surely he's not thinking about murder.
Well, then, I was worried about where his thoughts are tending. Maybe that's the way out, but let's hope not.
Well, we got some more clues in this one, didn't we?
Yeah,
Mark in inverted commas, and then when he said... Start saying back in the nick, probably. So we now know he's been to the nick.
Yeah.
So you're revealing a few more tasty tidbits.
That was a great way to show that he'd been in the nick.
Surprise
the reader. Although the reader, I guess at this point, would be going, what's his secret? What's his story?
Well, we've had the newspaper that he's been involved in.
I really feel the kind of pathos of his. He's kind of in love with Mariana and Peter, isn't he? And he's so afraid of them knowing what he really is. He's kind of carrying guilt and shame.
Yeah.
Not sure whether or not they'll forgive him. Feel that.
He's found a new life,
different
to anything he's had before, and he wants to hold on to it.
I was surprised that he'd moved in. Had you mentioned that before? Or is that just...
The extracts that have sort of... We've looked at a kind of skipping.
That's fine. Well, you know, you don't have to, it's like the transition, isn't it? You don't have to definitely say that he's moved in. We now know he's moved in, and that's.
She says, please stay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Until it all comes together.
Oh, yeah.
Then some of the transitions will happen then. Some
right.
Of it is just scenes.
Yeah, I understand that. I write
scenes,
that way.
Yeah, that need then to be sort of put into some sort of. coherent flow.
The story's coming along though, isn't it? I mean, it really is starting to flesh out now.
Very close to the end.
Well, I hope you know what's going to happen next. Because
we don't.
Anybody got any suggestions for improvement?
Yeah, I think in the third paragraph, at first it seemed to work well and Mark was happy feeling it, but gradually he began to feel he was losing Mariana. I didn't feel that you need to tell us that because you show really well that he starts to feel he's losing Mariana. And so with Peter back home, there were no more evenings looking at photographs. So you could have, he was feeling needed and valued, but with Peter back home, there were no more evenings looking at photographs.
I agree. The word losing pulled me up as well. I thought, is that quite the right word?
I thought it sounded more like a romantic or that wasn't appropriate.
Went back and read that bit again.
And the other thing I thought, but it's not necessarily in the beginning, we talked about him coming home and stuff, but I was expecting it wasn't until later that we learned he had no memory and couldn't talk, and I was wondering about that earlier, but I don't know if it needs to be moved. I don't know.
And did you wonder what Job Seekers was, to survive on Job Seekers?
No, because in America we have temp services, and so I figured it was something like that. Is that what it is?
No.
It's an allowance.
It's welfare. Welfare, you call it in America, isn't it?
Unemployed. In the third paragraph, I sort of queried that it's all questions. I think there are too many questions together. Stylistically, I don't feel it works. I think one is okay. And then I suggested, you know, where you put, would his speech improve? Would he be able to tell Mariana? You could possibly say something like, if his speech improved, he would be able to tell Mariana, and so on. That was just my feeling, that as a style thing, it's not great.
Right. I did think about that too, all the questions.
Yeah. And also, I thought Mark might feel that Peter is looking at him in a certain way, or even trying to signal something to Mariana, and that would make him anxious. So we would feel his anxiety more if we saw those things that were making him anxious. That was my feeling.
That's a lovely point.
Well, I didn't have any problem with that because she said he lost his memory. So if he's lost his memory,
you're right.
Think about those things.
But again, he might have that anxiety. How do you know he's lost his memory if he can't communicate?
I was pleased to discover that it had been an accident. Because it wasn't clear from the event before.
Yeah.
There was a lot of panic going on. Mark was blindly trying to get away, but it was an accident. But
generally, I thought it was really good. I'm wrapped up in the characters and situation. Mariana's voice is very distinct, and she's a delightful character. I think this moves the story along, but I think you could put a little more illustrative detail in. That's my general feeling.
Is she still wearing high heels?
Ooh, good point. I shall make a note.
Footwear is very important.
But I thought we knew before that it was an accident. I thought it was an accident. I've always thought it was an accident since it happened, because he. I just can't imagine, from the tone we'd had at that point, I can't imagine it would be an on purpose. It was, I always thought it was.
It was a moment of panic, wasn't it, when he saw the newspaper?
Well, he started pushing
that,
by. He wasn't
until he's rewriting anyway. That's
okay. Okay, so now we're going to have a little bit of a catch-up about what's been happening in our writing lives over the last few weeks. So, Nicola, what have you been up to?
She says like a rabbit caught in the headlights. I've been up to absolutely nothing on the writing front, although I've been thinking about it a lot, because I've just been so busy, what with going back to England and work and everything. But when the deadline came yesterday afternoon to submit my work in progress, I just started writing and it came out. So, you know, and I really feel I can carry on now. So I feel quite encouraged by that. It's weird. I just have to have a deadline before I do anything.
It's one of the difficulties that many of us have as writers, that especially, you know, we have this group and we give each other deadlines to produce something. But if you're on your own and nobody's setting a deadline, it really requires a great discipline. And I have a lot of admiration for people who have that discipline.
But it's a difficulty, yeah.
I've even got two big sections on Monday and Friday afternoon blocked out of my diary completely, and I just keep, everything else just keeps superseding it.
Yeah.
And I think I've just got to make a mental shift into being really serious about this, and I don't know why I haven't yet. I really want to write the book, and, you know I'm going to, but it's going to be in painfully slow increments at the moment.
Well, you know, Catch-22 took 7 years.
Did it? To write. Well, I totally understand now why writers talk about, you know, how long it takes to write a book, because it really well does take a long time.
Yeah. I think when you've never written anything, you think, well, just sit down and write.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And then you try it and you think, well, okay, it's not quite so straightforward.
No, it isn't. It's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, I think. But I'm still enjoying it, though.
Well, I find writing the story in the first place relatively easy.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm finding incredibly difficult is to go back, go through it again, and correct my mistakes.
Mm.
And I find that very time-consuming and really, really hard.
Yeah, because you're quite prolific and you can sit and write a few thousand words at a go, can't you?
They don't always make an awful lot of sense when I've done that, but actually going back and trying, and I realised that the one that I sent out for critique last time, everybody's given me some really valuable comments, but I've made him sound a bit stupid. And I didn't mean to, you know, it's not on purpose.
Yeah.
And poor Daniel now is, you know, feeling really quite aggrieved because I made him out to be so daft. Going back and trying to rewrite that so that it makes sense.
Yeah. It's being able to go back with a critical eye.
It is. And I think as well that there's that expression, isn't there, killing your darlings.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, and you come up with a wonderful phrase or a really beautiful metaphor.
Yeah.
And then you think, really, it doesn't need to be there. It's really hard to get rid of it when you...
Yeah, you do get attached to
your... You've got some sort of beautiful flow of words.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had one that fought with me all week. I mean, literally, throwing the fist and everything, because I was trying to leave it in and get rid of it at the same time.
That's a Catch-22 situation. Have you done much since we last talked about it?
I've done my regular Tuesdays.
Yeah.
I must admit, yesterday,
mm-hmm.
I was getting ready for now.
Yeah,
But, I've still got the Tuesdays and I still sit down.
Brilliant.
But I do find it easier to write the story than actually to make it make sense.
Well, yeah. Perhaps you're one of those writers who just needs to hire an editor and to edit your stuff, and you just need to keep putting it all over your face.
The more I listen about editors, it might cost me a fortune.
That's Nicola's answer. Far out.
Subcontracted.
I'll keep.
You could look at. I mean, some people write as a pair. There are lots of pairs of writers.
That's true.
You know, I mean, we talked to Charlie Burl a few weeks ago, and if you remember, he writes with another guy. They write together as Eddie Nugent. Now they tend to take different chapters and write in the same style. But there are other. There's a husband and wife team who write detective.
Yeah,
Nikki French.
That's the one.
I know that's right.
Individual.
Yeah. Yes, one of them's surname and one of them's first name. Yes,
and that's they actually write together. And so it might be that you can find somebody that has
a writing partner,
very good green.
You'll just get better at it. I think.
Or somebody that just listened in English lessons at school.
No, I think you'll get better at editing. I mean, you haven't been writing very long.
So you've come a long way anyway.
I'll keep trying.
Yeah.
I think you'll
notice.
Yeah, it's noticeable. Writing's come on,
definitely. And the the technical aspects of it are definitely better than the one.
Pat?
Yes, like Nicola. I'm a great one for deadlines, I think. But I think doing this last passage, I really sort of had to focus and start thinking about this end point, and having made certain decisions, I now have to go back. And because I've been doing this sort of kind of episodic thing for the last couple of months, I'm sort of now at the stage where I need to sort of restructure and work in those transitions, some of which I started doing, but it's been more thinking and and I think I've come to that decision in my head that when this is finally finished and I embark on my next piece, whatever that may be, I really do need to do more on the sort of pre-planning and plotting.
Right, that's interesting.
I mean, I did a sort of sketchy outline when I started this, but it's had several changes along the way. But I think that happens.
Yeah.
But I think you really do need, however, wherever it goes en route, I think having
a starting
point is probably fairly crucial.
And we're all learning by doing, but also when you're, you know, you can say, well, I haven't really done anything, but I've been thinking. But that's really an important part of the process. That's my excuse anyway. I do, I've said this before, I like things to gestate a long time before I actually write them down. I do think about things. Sometimes, not always, sometimes if it's just a free write and something comes and that becomes a story.
Yeah.
But generally I do.
When we spoke to Carrie Spray, she said in her short story writing, she knows the end. She knows where she's going, but she said it's a bit like, you can take the M6 or you can go around all the M&B roads.
Oh, yes,
to get
that's
to wherever
good,
you're
good
going.
Analogy.
Good analogy.
Yeah, so I think if you're right. If you know the end where you want to get to.
I mind, but I was, as a teacher, I always used to tell kids, you should know the ending before you start.
Yeah.
No, miss, you can't do that.
I mean, I found that as well with a story I wrote for a competition a couple of years ago. And I just started this story. And I didn't know where it was going. And it's harder, actually. Mm. And at some point, I thought, well, OK, they're going along this road and more people are getting in the car. How am I going to end this? And so actually, you know, and especially with a short story, the end is the most important part of it. You know,
otherwise,
so,
it starts being a short story, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
It's a long story.
Yeah. Stephanie?
Yes, well, I've been quite busy. I've had some help from a wonderful lady called Sue Meadows from No Stone Unturned Editing Services. And with her, we've completed three passes of the manuscript.
Wow.
Those of you who follow my blog will know that I've renamed it. It's now called Lacking Grace rather than Helen. I think Lacking Grace says more about what it's about. And, of course, Grace is the protagonist. I have not made the shortlist for two of the competitions I entered it for. There's another one I haven't heard from yet.
Mm.
And I've had three rejections from literary agents so far.
Bravo. Well, that's it.
Yeah, it's a numbers game.
Nearer to
it's
the end. Tick them off.
You're on your way.
I'm on my way, two of them were quite positive and helpful and interesting and their feedback. So they just said it's rubbish.
Yes.
So I'm pressing on. I'm researching agents who I think might be interested, but that in itself was quite time-consuming, working out. And then looking at what their list is and then reading samples of... That's like Kindle. Send a sample is great.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to buy the book.
Worse, read the whole book.
Just to kind of get a sense of the style and so on. And I've also been doing a bit of research in one of my favourite places, the old newspaper archives, and... because I'm trying to get some chapter headings using old, you know, historical references. So, so I'm working on that. And I've also been musing over some ideas for the next one.
Whoa! Exactly. That's the next thing. You'll have to start something.
You know, I think I want to stick with the sort of key themes of Lacking Grace, which is, you know, how family secrets and guilt and lies affect our whole lives, the way it affects our decision making.
Right.
So I think I'll stick with those themes.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much the theme of Lacking Grace. Mm. But that does interest me. But how I'm going to achieve that, I don't know. So,
do you know about the Daily Mail novel writing competition? Well, that's on at the moment. I'm not sure when it closed, but I did post it on the Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But maybe I'll post it again.
No, I'll have
a look.
I'll look that one up. Yeah,
I think you've got a few weeks to get it together.
I've got a few that need to be done in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
Did you manage to get a sample of the Stellar Grid that I told you about?
Probably.
Right.
Whether I've read it, I don't think I've read it yet. But yes, I did get a sample of that.
Hmm.
So just for the benefit of the listeners, Steph's looking at books and asking people to suggest books that are in a similar vein, and then you're looking at who their agents are. Yeah.
It's a match, yeah. I just don't want to sort of scatter gun.
No, of course,
no.
I'd like to sort of target it and find somebody to work with who, you know, is used to my kind of writing and my kind of themes and so on. So, I'm enjoying it. It's good.
You're enjoying the editing?
Yeah, I did enjoy that very much, working with somebody else.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's another interesting thing about working with a professional.
Yeah, and she came back with stuff that none of you had picked up on.
Ooh, well, there you go.
So she's your new best friend now.
She was really helpful. You know, she told me, I don't know if she, there is a tool you can use online on the Writers and Artists Yearbook website where you can... It will count the number of times you use particular words in the manuscript. And she picked up on some words that I use a lot, words and phrases that I used a lot, and then highlighted them so I could go through and just change. We didn't get rid of all of them, obviously, but just change some of them. So
everybody has those little
ticks.
Words. What's the Ian Rankin? I know in his book, people often steeple their hands. And I know what it means, but it wasn't a phrase I'd heard. But in his books, that like, they often do that.
Yeah, quite impressive. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
The benefit of listeners, everybody's sitting round with their fingers together.
So, Linda, what have you been up to in the last few weeks?
Oh, well, I just want to berate Nicola a little bit first, because she's saying she's blocked out the time, but she hasn't stuck to it.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of myself using my Heather method now, writing one day, setting one day a week now. And I have had guests this week, and I still sat Monday and did my Monday writing.
Oh, well done. Well done, you.
I just wanted to point out how good I am and how bad you are.
That makes me feel a whole lot.
And did Heather send Roy round with the...
Oh, right.
you really need to do the Heather method. You need Roy to arrive with lunch.
That's right, but I don't know that Roy's going to be willing to do that.
For all of us, anyway.
Yeah. Well,
that might incentivize me.
Roy is Heather's husband, as you might have guessed, and he does everything for her on Tuesday, so she doesn't have to get up from her writing position. She just sits there and writes. He brings her food, he brings her tea, and encouragement.
Yeah.
Excellent.
All hail Roy.
Yes. So anyway, moving on back to your writing.
Well, as you know, I've been writing in just scenes. I've been doing, I guess, what Stephen King would call seat of your pants writing. And then I haven't done anything like from beginning to end. I've just been writing scenes as they occur to me and things I know that will happen along the road as Mary Magdalene and Eli make their way to Little Rock. And I realized now that I have so many scenes that I've done that I like and want to keep that I'm going to have to start thinking about the structure and what goes before and the things that set up some of the scenes that are coming. Mm-hmm. So I actually sat down and started making a list of scenes that I'm going to need, and I realized I needed another character, and so now Aunt Sugar has entered the picture, and her cat Chitlins.
I love that cat. That's so good.
I'm really enjoying working with all these new people too, and there's a school teacher, we have Miss Patty. So I'm going back to do some earlier stuff because I need to set up the stuff I've been working on as sort of the middle as they're journeying along. So I need to go back and figure out why he's decided he, you know, can preach, etc. So that's what I've been doing, and it's been a lot of fun. I'm enjoying it a great deal.
Great. So it's going from little scenes to starting to be a novel.
Right. I'm starting to. I've reached the point where I have to go back and do the setup for the scenes I've written. Yeah.
Do you know how much material you've got in terms of thousands of words? Or
well, I have hundreds of pages, but they're not useful. They're not usable. Usually some of them are just, you know, redundant things that I've kept because maybe there's something in here I want to keep and I haven't read through it all because I've collected these kinds of things for years. I've been, this story's been in my head for many years. So as far as the ones that I think are usable, I probably have maybe 70, 80 pages right now. Yeah. And that's not bad.
That's good.
Pretty good.
How much is that in terms of words? 300 words to a page, didn't we say?
No, I don't think so. 250 a page.
250 a page.
Double space.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, maths, come on. So spring in.
Let's say 70.
250 is. 14,000.
Anybody out there know how to count?
I'd have to get a calculator. I'm a bit confused about books and lengths now, because we had that whole session at your house where we tried to work out how the 70,000 to 80,000 words.
Yeah, I thought it was 90,000.
The average novel is between 75,000 and 100,000 words.
Okay. See, I was reading something yesterday from doing my research, and Stephen Fry was saying 30,000 to 40,000 words.
Oh, well, his books are, you know,
are they?
Whatever.
Well, I thought they were quite chunky.
That sounds very short.
Okay.
He can get away with it because he's a celebrity.
You're looking for short tips, sweetie. You got to
stop that. Well, no, it's only because, you know, obviously 70,000 words when I've only done 6,000 is quite daunting. But I'm sure if I keep plugging away at writing the seams, then eventually I'll have something that comes together like you will.
Yeah. Or I may have lied. I may have lied about the number of pages.
So what about you yourself then?
Moving swiftly on.
Yes.
I'm doing research.
Oh, okay. Cool.
I haven't achieved a lot in the last few weeks, so I'll hold my hand up to that. I've been visiting my mum and preoccupied with other things. I've read bits of A Village Called Far Away on the podcast before, but I also have another fragmentary novel which you guys haven't seen, but it's similarly 2 or 3 chapters that don't quite fit together, which is set in the early 19th century. But I think now I've reached the point I need to really get serious about researching rather than just bluffing it. So I'm planning to get some books and do some proper research about the Greek revolution against the Turks and so on. Because the idea of the novel, it's partly set in Regency England and partly in Greece on the eve of the revolution. And the Regency England, I'm not saying I don't need to do research, but I feel I have a feel for that, you know, from my general reading and so on. But the Greek stuff I need to do some proper work. So that's my excuse for having nothing to contribute today.
So what's going to happen to the Village Called Far Away?
Oh, they'll probably go in parallel. You know what I'm like. I flip from one thing to the other. I'm very bad. Naughty.
Butterfly.
Yes. Dilettante, I think, is the word.
So what would happen if you didn't flip? What would happen if you sat down? Village Called Far Away is such a wonderful piece of work so far. What if you just sat with that one instead of flipping?
Well, then the other one wouldn't get done.
And she might get bored.
I don't know.
It would get stale. I think
Linda has a. It's a fair point.
Yes.
It is a fair
I think
point
Linda's been off and trained as a life coach somewhere because she's asking the hard questions that then everyone else is skipping over.
But it always seems to me like procrastination. If you're so, and I know
that is my middle name.
But to flip from one to the other means okay, I'm not going to give this priority. I'm not concerned about actually having a completed work. All I want to do is sit around and write the easy parts, and then. You know,
yeah.
Okay, have you been properly chagrined?
I've got a new word. It's called podcrastination. You don't have any writing because you spend all your time preparing and recording
podcasts.
It's
very true. We all suffer from that.
Yeah. Sorry, Nicola.
Going to say, I actually have, if I had a flip chart here, I could show you a management model that would actually prove to you that you never get anything done if you have more than one project on the go at one time.
Right.
It's something about the, you know, you just... The amount of time it takes you to finish 2 or 3 projects is proportionally larger than it would be if you just had the one on the go.
I can see that because you have to get yourself in that mindset for that. You know.
And you have to revise and review.
Back
to it.
I think you're all absolutely right. I will try hard.
Are you going to act on it? Are you going to get those stuff
far
away?
Yes.
She's obviously decided she doesn't want to be the class clown anymore. She's clearly decided that she's going to be the kind of schoolmistress.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, she's becoming a girly swot.
Oh.
No.
Anyway, when we meet again and discuss this again, we'll all have something to put on the table, I hope.
Yeah, and you'll have something else from Village Called Far Away.
I absolutely will. I make that commitment to you.
Oh, no.
Live on air.
Live on air, yes. Okay.
Great.
Today we're talking about the detective in fiction.
I think most of us enjoy reading a good detective story, and some of the most memorable and persistent characters in fiction have been detectives. And it's no coincidence that the detective as an archetype first emerges in English literature in the mid-19th century. Before this, there was no professional detective force. After an assassination attempt on Queen Victoria in 1842, a detective force was established at Scotland Yard, although the police force had been set up in 1829. The old system of catching criminals was based on offering rewards and hoping that other criminals would dob in the perpetrator. And obviously this was a very flawed system because people would dob anybody in for a reward, but however.
And they might even have done it themselves.
Yeah. Would you tell me what you mean when they dob in? Dob.
Grass? Grass them up?
Grass them up?
No. Okay. Wait, report them to the police.
Grass them
What
up.
Do you say when somebody, like a criminal...
Snitch?
Yeah.
Snitch? Something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, snitch. Yeah. A stool.
A stoolie.
Stool pigeon.
Stoolie. Or, anything but grass them up. My gosh. Okay.
Okay.
That's a new phrase she's learnt today.
Oh, yeah.
Dobbing is Australian.
Probably a lot of Australian
neighbours.
Yes, have come. Yes, and
tell on them.
Yeah.
Tell tales.
When the detective force was set up, many people were fascinated with this new character, this new figure in society. They were mistrusted to a great extent, considered to be spies. A lot of the early detectives in fiction were actually based on real characters, as we'll see. There are a number of different detectives. There's the police detective, the amateur detective, the private detective, and nowadays we have forensic detectives, profilers, all provide great material for fiction. Poe created one of the first detectives in fiction, but you can't really say there's a first because you always find that there's a short story somewhere with one in. An early detective who I find interesting is Inspector Bucket in Bleak House.
Great name.
Yeah, the names are good. Often considered to be the first police detective in fiction. But what about him becomes archetypal? What makes a detective interesting? A certain indefinable difference or otherness is one of the things that has been suggested. He notices everything and unnerves people with his steady stare. He can blend into the background when he wants to. Mm. His geniality catches people off guard. He disconcerts people with one last question. So, to quote, Mr. Bucket makes his three bows and is withdrawing when a forgotten point occurs to him. Who does that remind you of?
Yes.
Oh, it's Columbo. Yes. Yeah.
I love Columbo.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's one of the most loved police detectives, I think, Columbo. I think very popular. But it's his formidable intelligence that makes him really scary, and he revels in his work. He is fallible, he does make a false arrest at one point, but he is dogged in pursuing the truth, even though it does in the end bring down catastrophe. And there's some evidence that the character of Inspector Bucket was based on a real detective, Inspector Charles Frederick Field. In The Moonstone, Wilkie Collins gives us Sergeant Cuff. T.S. Eliot famously said The Moonstone's the first and greatest detective novel. And again, Cuff is supposedly based on the real Inspector Witcher, who, weirdly, has now become fictional.
Yes.
So the Inspector Witcher was a real person investigating the Road Hill House murders, I think. So Kate Summerscale wrote the non-fiction work, The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, about that murder. But there are parallels in The Moonstone, or certainly evidence that it's influenced by that. So in the real-life murder which Witcher investigated, there's a missing nightgown, a bloodstained nightgown, which is critical to the case. And in The Moonstone, there's a missing nightgown, but it's stained with paint rather than blood, but it's quite an important part of the story. So there are lots of other parallels that people have found. But it's interesting about Witcher that that's now become a fictional TV series. So he's kind of moved from real life into fiction. Yeah.
So Cuff, Sergeant Cuff in the book, is an elderly and sympathetic character with compassion and insight. And again, he does the first reconstruction, I think, that we have. So the novel climaxes when he reconstructs the theft of the Moonstone a year after the event. And he also gathers all the characters together in a style much favoured by Agatha Christie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there were many other Victorian detectives. There was an amateur female detective in Wilkie Collins' story, The Lady and the Law, Valeria Winter. In Hunted Down, Dickens employs a first-person narrative as an insurance investigator pursues a poisoner. And towards the end of the 19th century, we have the most famous gentleman amateur, Sherlock Holmes. And he introduces the naive sidekick, or maybe he doesn't introduce it, but he has the naive sidekick, which becomes often a part of the detective story. He has many eccentricities, and again, he has this superior intelligence. And one of the things that I think, when you have a detective who's so clever and spots things that nobody else spots, and the way that they're written and so on, I think the writers must be really clever, mustn't they? They must be geniuses, some of these people, the things they come up with. Other famous detectives, Miss Marple, a very unlikely character, elderly middle-class spinster living in rural England, and Agatha Christie's other famous detective Poirot, the pedantic, pompous foreigner. And, of course, he has the naive sidekick Hastings, who is a foil. There's no sign of waning in popularity. There are new detectives being invented, created all the time. So I particularly enjoyed Aidan Watts, a maverick cop who gets in too deep in the novel Sirens. But what about you? Who are your favourite detectives?
Well, I like Sue Grafton because she's funnier. I don't read that many detective novels because
Kinsey Mulholland,
yeah.
And so which is the detective and which is the author?
The author is Sue Grafton.
Right.
Okay. Her character is Kinsey Mulholland, is it Mulholland?
Yeah, right.
Sue Grafton does A is for alibi, B is for or something. And then I like to read the Janet Ivanovich novels, which are about Stephanie Plum. She's not a detective, but she's a bounty hunter, and she's really not very good at it, but she always comes out in the end. And yeah. I guess one of the things I really like is there's a hunk in there called Ranger that is great. But these are humorous things more, you know, and I like the lifestyle of the heroine or the detective person. All the others are so serious.
Mm. Right. But do you like the fact also that she doesn't get it right all the time?
I do, because it's just funny to watch her bumble and to get out of the bumble, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a great deal of fun. I think that Janet Ivanovich has done an awful lot. But as I said, she's a bounty hunter, not a detective.
Yeah, but in effect, it's another version of that archetype, isn't
That's
it?
That's right, yeah.
Well, I think there's a new archetype of detective which I'm very fond of, and that's the kind of female competing in a man's world, hard-driven, troubled, hard-drinking, with some sort of dark secret. And there are lots of those around, but I particularly like Linda LaPlante's Lorraine Page. And, of course, she also invented Jane Tennyson, who has to be a crime suspect TV series. But Lorraine was actually the first Linda LaPlante detective, and it was inspired by a true story. So much as you're talking about how Witcher became fictional, Linda LaPlante took the story of an American cop who seemed to have it all. She had a loving husband, beautiful children, she's very successful. Her part in the book, I mean, whether this is absolutely true, but it was inspired by a true story. Mm. Lorraine's life starts to unravel when her partner, her cop partner, is shot and dies in her arms. She starts drinking. She ends up killing a young boy when she's driving drunk. She gets fired from the police force and is rejected by her family. So that's, if you like, she couldn't be
rock bottom.
Yeah. She's no longer a police officer, but she gets involved in solving a crime. There's a serial murder around. She gets involved in solving that. So, and I guess what makes Jane Tennyson, Lorraine Page, and a number of other contemporary female detectives exciting is that, you know, they're women and they're people that we can sort of relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And people that are known for not how they got into the state that they're in, but what they do to resolve their issues and their problems. Yeah.
And I love Scott and Bailey, the UK TV series, and the character of Rachel Scott is just brilliant because she's so messed up and flawed, but she's a brilliant detective. She's a police detective, but she's
brilliant.
They are
all competing in a man's world. They're all down on their luck, but they're all brilliant detectives. And, brilliant at what they do. So I think that's a new archetype that we've started to see in the last 10-20 years.
One of my favourites.
Very human.
Yes.
I haven't read those, so that's going to be interesting. I'll try that out.
The TV version of Scott and Bailey was excellent.
I think it is just a TV series. I don't think it is.
No, Cass Denkliff.
Oh, really? They started from novels? I did not know that. I'll be reading those. But, of course, it was brilliantly scripted and brilliantly acted.
I'm not sure which came first.
Yeah, but interesting.
I'm on my Kindle.
I think Linda LaPlante's Joan Tennyson was a screenplay first and then went back to his novels. Whereas The Rain Page started as a novel. But Linda LaPlante's both a novelist and a screenwriter.
She is. But that's an interesting thing, you know, a relatively recent phenomenon where people are watching the film or the TV series and then saying, where's the book? I need a book. So that's quite interesting that we have those spin-offs.
The prequel of Prime Suspect.
That's
1973.
Yeah,
absolutely fascinating. I'm really quite
enjoying
it.
I enjoyed it.
I'll look for that.
That's very, very like Life on Mars. It's the kind of 70s, because the cops in the 70s were very different.
Smoke like chimneys, don't they? I feel almost get secondhand smoker's cough watching that.
Because the Red Riding trilogy as well gives you a good insight into the cops in the 70s. Do you have a favourite detective?
Oh, yeah. Lots. Probably, I might steal Nicola's thunder on this one, the Iwaszewski. Which is Sarah Paretsky.
I think you introduced me to that.
You mentioned that before. One of my book at bedtime.
That's right.
I think. But I also, you know, talking about the qualities of a detective, I was looking, my quote was echoing in my head and I sort of looked it up from Raymond Chandler, who did the Philip Marlowe, Big Sleep and so on. And he has actually written quite a lot about
the original noir.
Down these mean streets a man must go who is not himself mean, who is neither tarnished nor afraid. The detective in this kind of story must be such a man. He is the hero. He is everything. He must be a complete man and a common man, and yet an unusual man. He must be, to use a rather weathered phrase, a man of honour, by instinct, by inevitability, without thought of it, and certainly without saying it. He must be the best man in the world, in his world, and a good enough man for any world.
Mm. Wow.
And I think if you actually...
Yes, exactly.
If you actually apply the qualities to, you know, some of the best detectives that you read, whether male or female, and I think a lot of that does come through. That kind of fallibility, but the ability to rise above it. I think that's good. And I think...
I'm just wondering...
Wachowski does, I think she fits that.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if those things have got a bit more blurred and that the detective, the modern detective, the contemporary detective, isn't always as morally honourable, you know, that they, you know, maybe we've moved more towards anti-heroes. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
One of my others is Rebus.
Definitely fallible. And they usually have something like, for instance, Morse does crosswords and listens to classical music, and that kind of sets him as a more intelligent person. And, you know, or they listen to jazz, or there's something which is, you know.
Well, then you've got people like Jack Parlebaine in Christopher Brookmyre's. Which, if you like humour, Linda, you'll enjoy those because they're ridiculous, ridiculous and funny. And he almost kind of stumbles into. He's a good detective, but he almost kind of stumbles into the answers sometimes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I'll have to pick that one up.
Yeah,
Heather.
I've realised that I quite like double acts.
Yeah,
and, you know, and unfortunately, say mostly American. People like Kathy Wright with Bones and Booth, Tess Gerritsen with Rosolian Isles again, which was a television series, Jonathan Kellerman, he writes as Alex Delaware, the psychologist, and the policeman's Milo Sturgis, and Faye Kellerman writes about Peter Decker and Rena Lazarus. Mm-hmm. So, and a health kind of thing, you know.
Yes.
Doctors, consultants, yeah. Or yeah. Something. Yeah. I didn't actually realise that I'd move that into what I read. Yeah. But I also like Ellis Peters.
Yes.
I think that, you know, because it's portraying this really, you know, sort of good, genuine, honest
yes.
chap.
Yes.
And G.K. Chesterton's Father mm-hmm. Brown, mm-hmm. again, which, you know, sort of is this. You know, mm-hmm. Rather bumbly, but yeah. very honourable.
Do you like D.L. and Pasta? That's another double
yes,
S.
Yes,
there's a whole, there's about 14, 15 of those books.
Yeah, and so what is it about the double S, leaving aside Cadfael, because
wait,
that's not
the
one.
What is double S?
Two protagonists, I suppose.
Two detectives yeah. working together.
Yeah. Or a detective and someone else.
Starsky okay. and Hutch?
Yeah,
a team.
I was going to say.
A lot of the ones that I like have got one person who is a detective and the other one isn't.
Okay.
So they either do it by accident
okay.
or, you know, mm-hmm. sort of work
okay.
together.
And is it, I mean, and I'm just musing and throwing this out for me and everyone else, what is it about that double act? Is it that they can converse and discuss the case? Do they spark off each other, bring different qualities?
For me, I think it's the difference of opinion between those people, because if some detectives, because that's their job, that's what mm-hmm. they do, can almost be boring.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, sort of a psychologist and a policeman, they're going to see a different side to things.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so,
like the Val
that
do.
I think in the actual telling of the writing of the story,
mm-hmm.
It gives you, the writer, more options.
Right.
You know, to in the methods of, you know, revealing thought processes and moving things along.
Yeah.
Whereas solo detective, I'm just thinking about some of them. A lot of them are first person narrative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By necessity.
Yeah. Yeah. Terry Hayes' I Am Pilgrim has got a police officer, mm-hmm. Ben, and the person who's telling the story.
Mm-hmm.
And between them, they're solving the.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit sort of John le Carré style, you know, lots of characters and lots of intrigue, but that works quite well. Yeah, so I guess it's a bit like Sherlock Holmes and Watson.
Yeah,
having that sidekick.
Yeah. I think in Scott and Bailey they complement each other. They're friends most of the time, but one of them has a more stable, normal life.
Mm-hmm. Cagney and Lacey.
One has a chaotic personal life.
Oh, there's a lot of them, isn't there? Hawaii Five-O has just sprung to mind, but I'd like to make an honourable mention for the first ever detective I got really interested in, which was Scooby-Doo and Shaggy.
Hey.
Every week they solved a new, usually supernatural crime, and it really got me fascinated
and
in the whole
janitor.
Genre. Yeah, it was. Yes.
But, there was always somebody wearing masks.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And there was always someone dressed up as a ghost, pretending to be a ghost.
Yeah.
So when you saw the ghost, you usually knew that was the perpetrator. Perp, as they're known in but I've got a good old list here. I won't read out the ones that I love that, you know, you've already mentioned, but there was Wexford, Ruth Rendell, enjoyed all that. And then Adam Dalgleish was P.D. James. Mm-hmm. And one of my earliest favourites was a chap, I've been able to find it online, but his name was Sir Peter something.
Sir Peter Wimsey.
That's it.
Yeah,
absolutely loved those. I could not get enough of them.
And there are lots of those on Radio 4.
Couldn't get enough of them. And then going on to more modern ones, which is, you know, Jack Reacher, Harry Bosch, D.S. Grace, who's Peter James, who writes everything set in Brighton. Obviously, I love that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do find his books really, really well done. The most recent ones, I love Vera on television. She's a Columbo-style female detective.
Yeah.
And she lives out on the moors and drives a Land Rover and drinks whiskey and always wears a scabby old raincoat. So she's brilliant. It's very gentle. It's not because Sarah, you know, my sister Sarah, who lives with me sometimes, she doesn't like violent stuff on telly.
Yeah.
So
people
who don't like the more violent stuff would enjoy Vera.
I think you don't see the violence, but she is investigating violent crimes.
Then I was thinking about Grantchester, which is your detective with a priest, which is an interesting combination, and both really good actors.
Again, very troubled priest.
He's a very troubled priest. But my real favourites at the moment are Penn Cage from the Greg Ilse books that I mentioned regularly on the show. I love Kay Scarpata. She's now who writes that? Patricia Cornwall. Dark, dark characters in that, and I find them absolutely intriguing. And the way it plays out, there's the niece who's very manly and superhuman almost, and then there's the boyfriend, and then the boyfriend actually dies at one point, and they have to keep it from Kay for her own safety. And that whole psychological thing of that they weave into the books among the characters, let alone what's happening in the murder mysteries, is
very complex.
Deep and complex. Yeah, and then you know, an honourable mention for the Kate Atkinson detective, whose name escapes me because I just came across the Kate Atkinson books recently and absolutely love them.
Yeah. Well, we'll find the name and
we'll do it. We've got a lot of links
for this show, and I can't go without mentioning Saga Noren, Saga and Martin in The Bridge. What a great double act that is.
Well, that's a whole new genre that's emerging. I've got Harry Hole written down here, or is it Harry Hole? Joe Nesbo.
Oh, yeah.
And I've read all of those. They're absolutely gripping.
Again, I don't know if The Bridge was a novel or just a TV series, but it's still
the whole Scandi noir thing is coming up.
She's such a great character and so convincingly acted. And again, it's the contrast between somebody who is quite rigid and plays by the rules, and Martin is the more chaotic in his personal life and also in his approach to his work. Mm. And that works very well. The first two series of The Bridge, I thought, were really, really good. Yeah. Okay, so if you were going to create a detective, what sort of a detective would you create?
I would probably have somebody that's easily underestimated. So a bit like Columbo, but she'd be plain. It would be a she. Mm-hmm. She'd be plain. She'd be unremarkable. I was thinking maybe a grandmother who is into knitting or embroidery, and somehow that hobby would help her to unravel the mystery. There'd be something...
Right, okay.
I was thinking, you know, maybe there could be a clue in the knitting or something.
Who was the lady man with fire?
Knitting the names of the...
I like the female detectives, and I like the Columbo style, you know, somebody that could be underestimated. And I guess Vera's a bit like that, Nicola mentioned, you know.
I guess, I mean, obviously, you know, she is... you know, a professional police detective, but when people first see her, she just looks like an old country woman.
That would be my character.
Right, but nice to bring in the needlework. That's a good idea.
I think in a way mine's a bit similar because I thought of a librarian. Because somebody that you would not suspect, you know, has got a personal life, you think actually lives in the library, you know, books at night, and picking up on the kind of books that people are taking out, you know, kind of research.
Interesting.
So you'd be able to tell who's planning a murder. Yeah.
So, if you're a librarian, do let us know. Do you live in the library or do you have a life?
I don't know. I think I'd go probably for the more of the sort of Wachowski, Soup, Kinsey Mahone type of thing, but in an English setting. Yep. Yes, female, strangely enough. Maybe should try writing as a man. That might be different. Might be interesting. Probably quite a troubled personality. Mm-hmm. She would get into, almost accidentally, sorting out some mystery.
She would be a detective.
But it becomes a solution to kind of what to do with my life situation.
Yeah.
And maybe that would be the end of the novel.
That sounds good.
For the whole series.
Yeah.
26.
Well, I'd have to write a space detective novel, obviously.
Of course you would.
And I did look to see if there were any good ones that, you know, my wide readings are in the science sci-fi genre. And there was actually Douglas Adams who did one, but I do remember reading that, but I couldn't find any others that I'd really struck me.
There you go.
There
you go.
There is an opening.
There is your niche.
A private detective.
I think that's one of those things that could start a whole new genre, actually, Nicola, if you did, in the way that Cad File kind of sparked a whole genre.
Historical detectives.
So that's a really good idea. Have you got one, Linda?
Well, yeah, I want to have a brilliant criminal, just the best criminal mind ever, and he's in prison. So this would have to be a double act because there's someone on the outside who is faced with a problem they can't solve, and every book they have to come to him back and forth to say, okay, this is what's happened so far, can you tell me what to look for next? And this brilliant criminal just
runs all
of this. So it's a bit like Silence of the Lambs meets The Blacklist.
Yeah.
Where that's a great character where he's watch The Blacklist? It's,
The character's
The Red, yes. Okay. And James Spader. Great choice as well because he's quite not anonymous looking, but he's actually a brilliant criminal mastermind and he starts bringing... so it's about 100 most wanted criminals on the blacklist.
Oh, yeah?
And he starts bringing one criminal after the other to the FBI because he wants to get closer to someone who may or may not be his daughter and she's become an FBI agent. He'll only work with her. Wow. Fascinating concept. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about you, Teresa? Who's your detective?
I don't think I've got it in me. I don't know, I haven't really. I am in awe of all the things you've said. But what I was thinking, Linda, was couldn't Mary Magdalene grow up to be a detective?
I was just thinking that.
She's so bright and so sassy.
Yeah.
And she you could just take this character right through her life. It'd be amazing.
Yeah.
Well, in the book I'm working on now, Mary Magdalene does not become a detective. So maybe that's something for
that's
the future.
Sequel.
Yeah.
Yeah, or, you know, so you could take some of her attributes maybe into an adult.
She's very clever, isn't she?
Yeah, and looks at the world a whole different way.
Yeah. It's nearly time to wrap up for this week, but before we do, there's just time for Stephanie and Andy Larter to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Steph, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I'm reading Friend Request by Laura Marshall. I'll just read you the first line. It will tell you what it's all about. It opens 2016. The email arrived in my inbox like an unexploded bomb. Maria Weston wants to be friends on Facebook. For a second, I miss the Facebook reference and just see Maria Weston wants to be friends. Instinctively, I slam the laptop shut. It feels as though a sponge has been lodged in my throat, soaking up water, swelling and clogging, leaving me struggling for breath. I attempt to breathe deeply, trying to get myself back under control. Perhaps I was mistaken. I must have been mistaken because this cannot possibly be happening. Slowly, I raise the lid of my laptop. Hands shaking, I go back into the email, and this time there is no denying the bald fact of it. Maria Weston wants to be friends with me. And at the end of that first chapter, it ends, but Maria Weston has been dead for 25 years.
Oh.
This book is exploring the kind of things that fascinate me, like, you know, how guilty secrets from things that happened in your past life impact the decisions that you make throughout your life and impact so many things.
Mm.
And, you know, if anybody has a secret from their school years, and I'm sure we all do, but in this case, Maria Weston was somebody who wanted to be friends with Louise at school.
Mm-hmm.
And something happened. I won't spoil it for everybody.
Wow.
But, and now Maria Weston should be dead, but it seems perhaps she isn't. And it's fabulous. And the reason I wanted to read this is because Laura Marshall is going to be talking to us on the show in a couple of weeks' time. So,
wow, that sounds
She's got another
brilliant.
Book about to come out, Three Little Lies, will be coming out at the end of June, I believe. So she said that she'll come and talk to us. So I'm really looking forward to that. It was on my bedside table anyway, but it kind of leapt to the top of the
pot. Talking about grabbing people.
The thing is, it could happen to any of us, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Can you imagine getting an email from somebody from your past that maybe, I mean, there's somebody, all of us have got somebody we don't want to hear from.
That's right.
I've blocked them in advance. I've already blocked them on Facebook, no problem.
It's on my Kindle to read. I did that yesterday.
It's brilliant.
Okay. No, it does sound
really
good.
Yeah.
So, Andy Larter of the Eastcott Writers Group, what's on your bedside table?
On my bedside table at the moment are two novels by Graham McRae Burnett. He was nominated for the Booker Prize last year, and I read that novel as well, but that's not on the bedside table anymore. It's these two. The first one is called The Disappearance of Adèle Bedeux, and the second one is called The Accident on the A35. And they're both set in a town called Saint-Louis, which is right down in the south-east corner of France, near Strasbourg and Mulhouse, not a very appealing place by all accounts. And they concern a detective inspector called Georges Gorski, They are detective novels, ostensibly. Gorski, the detective, smokes too much, drinks too much. He has problems in his relationship with his wife. His mother is suffering from dementia, early stages of dementia. So he's got a lot of problems in his life, which so far sounds like a typical detective sort of thriller. In the first one, The Disappearance of Adele Bedeau, the novel isn't really about the disappearance of this woman at all. She's disappeared and her boyfriend has been interviewed and all that kind of thing. But the novel really concentrates on Gorski himself, but even more so on this fella called Manfred Baumann, who's got a German name, but he's actually French. And he's a bit of a loner, an oddball, a really strange man who doesn't wear any clothes other than suit. Well, why not? Until he goes for a walk in the countryside with one of his girlfriends and all he's got to wear is a suit and fancy shoes that he would wear to work. That's quite amusing until something happens on the walk and it gets a little bit more kind of murky. Quite funny. He's also got some other dark secrets, one of which I won't tell you. You'll have to read the novel to find out. But the other one is his regular visits to Madame Simone's establishment. Can I leave that to your imagination to work out what that is as well? And he has some strange predilections there as well. At one point, he tells one of the girls to keep her legs together. Yes, I'll leave that one there as well. His inner life is very, very interesting, but it's not really a detective thriller. The second one, The Accident on the A35, again, is it a detective thriller? This man, Barthelm, has been killed in a car accident, and Gorski goes to tell his wife, his widow. And when he gets there, she doesn't react particularly badly to it. She doesn't break down or anything. And she says, well, what was he doing on the A35 anyway? Because on a Tuesday night, he usually goes and visits his friends in the local restaurant. So what was he doing on that road anyway? And also I've noticed that he takes a lot of money out of our bank account on a Tuesday before he goes to meet his friends. I thought it was because they were having expensive meals. So Gorski decides that he's going to investigate this crime that didn't really happen. Something has happened, but Gorski finds out after Barthelm's son, Raymond, who is a budding existentialist. Also, he thinks anyway. Quite amusing the way that he depicts Raymond. But crime novels that are not really crime novels. Crime novels that investigate crimes that don't exist. And quite amusing, very, very good writing, delving into character in a way that I wish I could without sounding cheap and hopeless. He's a very good writer. Yes. I would seriously recommend Graham McRae Burnett.
Thank you, Andy. Sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. But before we go, there's just time to remind you about our current competition, which closes in just 10 days. We're looking for short stories of up to 2,000 words with the theme On the Way. All the details are on our Write Club, the podcast Facebook page. The competition is free to enter and there will be a prize of a Write Club the Podcast canvas bag of books from some of our favourite writers and stationery goodies. Next week we'll be talking about language, profanities, sensitivities and political correctness with Jill Simpson. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a review. Bye!
Bye!